Ringing Vale. 1. A mountain valley renowned for the many small streams that spill down its rocky walls from glaciers poised above, producing a musical sound likened to the ringing of chimes, also known as the Rill Vale, or, poetically, Vale of a Thousand Rills. 2. A math founded there in 17 AR, specializing in study and developments of martial arts and related topics. See Vale Lore. Vale Lore. 1. In New Orth, an omnibus term covering armed and unarmed martial arts, military history, strategy, and tactics, all of which are strongly associated in the mathic world with the avowed of the Ringing Veil, who have made such topics their specialty since a math was founded there in 17 AR. Note, in informal speech and in Fluckish, the word is sometimes contracted to vlor. However, note that this variant emphasizes the martial arts side of Vale lore at the expense of its more academic and bureaucratic aspects. Extramuros, vlor is an entertainment genre, and, for those seculars who can be moved to stand up and practice such things, as opposed to merely watching them, a type of academy. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Working in a hole in the ground had made me ignorant of all these goings-on, but now that Jessery had let me know that my Fras and sewers were working so hard, I redoubled my efforts with the tablet. Stored on that thing, I had all of 17 clear nights. Once I got the knack, it took me about half an hour's work to configure the tablet to give me the time exposure for a given night. Then, using a protractor, I would spend another half hour or so measuring the angles between streaks. As Jessery had predicted, some birds made slightly larger angles than others, reflecting their longer periods, but the angle for a given bird was always the same, every orbit, every night. So, in a sense, it only took a single night's observations to make a rough draft of the senses. But I went ahead and did it for all 17 of the clear nights anyway, just to be thorough, and because, frankly, I had no idea what to do next. I could polish off one, sometimes two nights' observations every time I got a chance to go down into that subcellar, but I didn't get that chance every day. By the time I finished, I'd been at it for about 3 weeks. Buds were out on the page trees. Birds were flying north. Fras and sewers were poking around in their tangles, arguing about whether it was time to plant. The barbarian weed horde was marshaling on the riverbank and getting ready to invade the fertile plains of Thrania. Arcibald was about two-thirds of the way through his pile of Paphlagon. The vernal equinox was only a few days away. Appert had begun on the morning of the autumnal equinox, half a year ago. I could not understand where the time had gone. It had gone the same place as all the thousands of years before it. I had spent it working. It didn't matter that my work was secret, illicit, and could have got me thrown back. The consent didn't care about that. Certain persons would have cared a lot, but this was a place for the avowed to spend their lives working on such projects. And now that I had a project, I was a part of that consent in a way I'd never been before, and the place was the right place for me. Since Arcibald, Jessery, and Tullia had their minds on other projects, I didn't tell them about Saman. That was a topic reserved for Leo when we were out in the meadow coaxing the star blossom to grow in the right direction. Or, since it was Leo, doing whatever else had most recently jumped into his mind. We had reacted in different ways to the loss of Orlo. In my case, it was bloody revenge fantasies that I kept to myself. Leo, on the other hand, had become entranced by ever weirder varieties of vlor. 2 weeks ago, he had tried to get me interested in rake vlor, which I guessed was inspired by the story of Dyax casting out the enthusiasts. I had declined on grounds of not wanting to get a blood infection. A weaponized rake could give you mass-produced puncture wounds. Last week, he had developed a keen interest in shovel vlor, and we had spent a lot of time squatting on the riverbank, sharpening spades with rocks. When he led me down to the river again one day, I assumed it was for more of the same, but he kept looking back over his shoulder and leading me in deeper. I'd been on enough furtive expeditions as a fid to know that he was checking the sightlines to the warden regulance windows. Old habits kicked in. I became silent and moved from one shady place to another until we had reached a place where the bending river had cut away the bank to form an overhang, sheltered from view. Fortunately, no one was there having a liaison just now. It would have been a bad place for it anyway. Mucky ground, lots of bugs, high probability of being interrupted by Avout messing around on the river in boats. Leo turned to face me. I was almost worried that he was going to make a pass at me. But no, this was Leo we were talking about.
"I'd like you to punch me in the face," he said,
as if he were asking me to scratch his back. Not that I haven't always dreamed of it," I said, "but why would you want it?"
"Hand-to-hand combat has been a common element of military training down through the ages," he proclaimed, as if I were a fid. "Long ago, it was learned that recruits, no matter how much training they had received, tended to forget everything they knew the first time they got punched in the face."
"The first time in their lives, you mean?"
"Yeah. In peaceful, affluent societies where brawling is frowned on, this is a common problem."
"Not being punched in the face a lot is a problem?"
"It is," Leo said. "If you join the military and find yourself in hand-to-hand combat with someone who is actually trying to kill you."
"But Leo," I said, "you have been punched in the face. It happened at Appert, remember?"
"Yes," he said, "and I've been trying to learn from that experience."
"So why do you want me to punch you in the face again?"
"As a way to find out whether I have learned."
"Why me? Why not Jesri? He seems more the type."
"That is the problem."
"Oh, I see your point. Why not Arcibald, then?"
"He wouldn't do it for real. And then he'd complain that he had hurt his hand."
"What are you going to tell people if you show up for dinner with a busted face?"
"That I was battling evildoers."
"Try again."
"That I was practicing falls and landed wrong."
"What if I don't want to mess up my hand?" He smiled and produced a pair of heavy leather work gloves.
"Stuff some rags under the knuckles," he suggested as I was pulling them on, "if you're that worried about it."
Grand Sewers Tamara and Alma drifted by on a punt. We pretended to pull weeds until they were out of sight.
"Okay," Leo said. "My objective is to perform a simple takedown on you."
"Oh, now you tell me."
"Nothing we haven't done 100 times, he said,
as if I would find this reassuring.
"That's why we came here."
He stomped the damp sand of the riverbank.
"Soft ground."
"Why?"
"If I put up my hands to defend my face, I won't be able to complete my objective."
"I get it." Suddenly he came at me and took me down.
"You lose,"
he proclaimed, getting up. "Okay," I sighed, and clambered to my feet. Immediately he wheeled around and took me down again. I threw a playful blow at his head way too late. This time he took me down a lot harder. Every one of the small muscles in my head felt as if it had been strained. He planted a dirty hand on top of my face and shoved off while getting back to his feet. The message was clear. The next time I tried for real, but I didn't have my feet planted and wasn't able to hit very hard, and he was coming in too low. The time after that, I got my center of gravity low, planted my feet in the mud, made a bone connection from hip to fist, and drilled him right on the cheekbone.
"Oh, good,"
he moaned as he was climbing off of me.
"See if you can actually slow me down, though. That's the whole point, remember?"
I think we did it about 10 more times. Since I was suffering a lot more abuse than he was, I sort of lost track. On my best go, I was able to throw him off stride for a moment, but he still took me down. "How much longer are we going to do this?" I asked, lying in the mud in the bottom of an Erasmus-shaped crater. If I refused to get up, he couldn't take me down. He scooped up a double handful of river water and splashed it on his face, rinsing away blood from nostrils and eyebrows.
"That should do," he said. "I've learned what I wanted."
"Which is?" I asked, daring to sit up.
"That I've adjusted since what happened at Appert."
"We did all that to obtain a negative result?" I exclaimed, getting to my knees.
"If you want to think of it that way,"
he said, and scooped up more water. I'd never get such a fine opportunity again, so I rolled up put a foot in his backside and sent him headlong into the river. Later, as Leo was engrossed in the comparatively normal and sane activity of shovel sharpening, I got us back on the topic of what I'd been seeing in the tablet, specifically, Saman's behavior during his noon visits.
"Has this Ida tried to communicate with you?"
Leo asked through puffy lips. "You mean like sneaking into the math at night to slip me notes?" Leo was baffled by my answer. He showed this in his usual way by correcting his posture. The scrape of the rock on the shovel paused for a moment. Then he got it.
"No, I don't mean in real time," he said. "I mean, on the tablet, does he, you know?"
"No, Thistlehead, I have to confess I haven't the faintest idea."
"If anyone understands surveillance, it's those guys,"
Leo pointed out. "If you buy into Sant Padagar's assertion, sure." Leo seemed disappointed that I was so naive as not to believe this. He went back to work on that rock. The scraping really set my teeth on edge, but I reckon it must be putting the hurt on any spies who might be eavesdropping. Apparently my new role at the consent of Sant Edhar was to be the sheltered innocent. I said, "Well, answer me this. If they have us under total surveillance, they must know everything about me and the tablet, right?"
"Well, yeah, you think so."
"So why hasn't anything happened?" I asked him. "It's not like Spellicon and Trestinus have soft spots for me."
"That doesn't surprise me," he insisted. "I don't think there's anything strange about that."
"How do you figure?" He paused long enough to give me the idea he was making up an answer on the spot. He dipped his sharpening rock into the river.
"The Ida can't be telling the Warden Regulant everything they know. Trestinus would have to spend every minute of every day with them to take in so much intelligence. The Ida must make decisions as to what they will pass on and what they will withhold."
What Leo was saying opened up all sorts of interesting scenarios that would take me some time to sort out. I didn't want to stand there with my mouth hanging open any longer than I already had, so I bent down and grabbed the handle of the shovel. It wasn't going to get any sharper. I looked around for a stand of slashberry that needed to be massacred. It didn't take long to find one. I made for it, and Leo followed me. "Well, that's giving the Ida a lot of responsibility," I said, raising the shovel, then driving it down and forward into the roots of the slashberry canes. Several of them toppled. Most satisfying.
"Assume that they are as intelligent as we are," Leo said. "Come on, they operate complicated syntactic devices for a living. They created the reticulum. No one knows better than they do that knowledge is power. By employing strategy and tactics in what they say and what they don't, they must be able to get things they want."
I took down a square yard of slashberry while thinking about what he said.
"You're saying there's a whole world of Ida hierarch politics going on over there that we know nothing about?"
"Has to be, or else they wouldn't be human," Leo said.
Then he used hypertrochian transquestiation on me. He changed the subject in such a way as to imply that the question had just been settled, that he had won the point and I had lost.
"So, back to my question. Does Saman do anything else on the tablet that sends you a message, or at least indicates he knows that his image is being recorded?"
He chucked his sharpening rock into the river. The correct response to hypertrochian transquestiation was, "Hey, not so fast!" But Leo's question was so interesting that I didn't make a fuss. "I don't know," I had to admit, after I'd spent an enjoyable minute or so taking down more slashberry.
"I'm getting bored measuring pie slices, and I honestly don't know what else to look at next. So I'll have a look."
After that, I couldn't get into the cellar for almost a week. The consent was getting ready for some equinox celebrations, and so I had chant rehearsals. The weed war was entering a stage that demanded I draw at least one sketch of it. I had to get my tangle planted. When I was free, there always seemed to be other people at Shuf's Dalment. The place was becoming hip.
"Be careful what you wish for,"
Arcibald moaned to me one afternoon. I was helping him carry a stack of beehive frames into a wood shop.
"I invited one and all to use the Dalment. Now they are doing so, and I can't work there."
"Nor I," I pointed out.
"Now this."
He He picked up a putty knife, which I was pretty sure was the wrong tool for the job, and began to pick absentmindedly at a patch of rotten wood on the corner of a frame.
Disaster!
Do you know anything about woodworking? I asked.
No,
he admitted. How about the metatheorical works of Fra Paflagon?
That I know a few things about,
he said.
And what is more, I think Orlo wanted us to learn about them.
How so?
Remember our last dialogue with him?
Pink nerve gas farting dragons? Of course.
We must come up with a more dignified name for it before we commit it to ink,
Archibald said with a grimace.
Anyway, I believe that Orlo is pushing us to think about some of the ideas that are important to his mentor.
Well, funny he didn't mention Paflagon in that case, I pointed out. I remember talking about the later works of Sant Evan Edric, but
one leads to the other. We would have found our way to Paflagon in due course.
You would have, maybe, I said. What's it all about? This seemed a reasonable question, but Archibald flinched.
The sort of stuff Procyons hate us for.
Like the Hylaean Theoric world? I asked.
Thus what they would call it, as a backhanded way of suggesting we are naive. But starting at least as early as Protus, the idea of the HTW was developed into a more sophisticated metatheorics, so you could say that Paflagon's work is to classical Proton thought what modern group theory is to counting on one's fingers,
but still related to it.
Certainly.
I'm just thinking back to my conversation with that Inquisitor.
Verax?
Yeah. I'm wondering whether his interest in the topic...
Correction? He was interested in whether we were interested in it,
Archibald pointed out.
Yeah, exactly. Whether that might be further evidence for the existence of the hypothetical important fit of Sura Aculoa. I think we should be careful speculating about the hyphosa until Sura Tullia has actually found evidence of his or her existence,
Archibald said.
Otherwise, we'll be coming up with all manner of speculations that would never make it past the rake.
Well, without telling me everything you know about it, I said, can you give me a clue as to why anyone in the secular world would think Paflagon's work might be of practical importance?
Yes, he said, if you fix this beehive for me. You know about atom smashers, particle accelerators?
Sure, I said. Praxic-age installations, huge and expensive, used to test theories about elementary particles and forces.
Yes, Archibald said. If you can't test it, it's not theorics, it's metatheorics, a branch of philosophy. So, if you want to think of it this way, our test equipment is what defines the boundaries separating theorics from philosophy.
Wow, I said. I'll bet a philosopher would really jump down your throat for talking that way. It's like saying that philosophy is nothing more than bad theorics.
There are some theors who would say so, Archibald admitted.
But those people aren't really talking about philosophy as philosophers would define it. Rather, they are talking about something that theors begin to do when they get right up to the edge of what they can prove using the equipment they've got. They drive philosophers crazy by calling it philosophy or metatheorics.
What kind of stuff are you talking about?
Well, they speculate as to what the next theory might look like. They develop the theory and try to use it to make predictions that might be testable. In the late Praxic Age, that usually meant constructing an even bigger and more expensive particle accelerator.
And then came the terrible events, I said.
Yes, no more expensive toys for theors after that, Archibald said. But it's not clear that it actually made that much of a difference. The biggest machines in those days were already pushing the limits of what could be constructed on Arbor with reasonable amounts of money.
I hadn't known that, I said. I always tend to assume there's an infinite amount of money out there.
There might as well be, Archibald said. But most of it gets spent on pornography, sugar water, and bombs.
There is only so much that can be scraped together for particle accelerators.
So the turn to cosmography might have happened even without the reconstitution.
It was already happening, Archibald said, as the theors of the very late Praxic Age were coming to terms with the fact that no machine would be constructed during their lifetimes that would be capable of testing the theorics to which they were devoting their careers.
So those theors had no alternative but to look to the cosmos for givens.
Yes, Archibald said. And in the meantime, we have people like Fra Paflagon.
Meaning what? Both Theors and philosophers? He thought about it.
I'm trying to respect your earlier request that I not simply bury you in Paphlagon, he explained when he caught me looking. But this forces me to work harder.
Fair is fair, I pointed out, brandishing a cross-cut saw that I had been putting to use.
You could think of Paphlagon, and presumably Orlo, as descendants of people like Evanedric.
Theors, I said, who turned to philosophy when Theorix stopped.
Slowed down, Arcibald corrected me, waiting for results from places like Sant Bunjo's.
Bunjo was a millenarian math built around an empty salt mine 2 miles underground. Its fras and sewers worked in shifts, sitting in total darkness, waiting to see flashes of light from a vast array of crystalline particle detectors. Every 1,000 years, they published their results. During the first millennium, they were pretty sure they had seen flashes on 3 separate occasions, but since then, they had come up empty.
So, in the meantime, they've been fooling around with ideas that people like Evanedric came up with when they reached the edge of Theorix?
Yes, Arcibald said. There was a profusion of them, right around the time of the Reconstitution, all variations on the theme of the polycosm.
The idea that our cosmos is not the only one.
Yes, and that's what Paphlagon writes about when he isn't studying this cosmos.
Now I'm a little confused, I said, because I thought you told me just a minute ago that he was working on the HTW.
Well, but you could think of protism, the belief that there is another realm of existence populated by pure theoretical forms, as the earliest and simplest polycosmic theory, he pointed out.
Because it posits 2 cosmi, I said, trying to keep up. One for us and one for isosceles triangles?
Yes.
But the polycosmic theories I've heard about, the circa reconstitution ones, are a whole different kettle of fish. In those theories, there are multiple cosmi separate from our own, but similar, full of matter and energy and fields, always changing, not eternal triangles.
Not always as similar as you think, Arcibald said. Paphlagon is part of a tradition that believed that classical protism was just another polycosmic theory.
How could you possibly...
I can't tell you without telling you everything, Arcibald said, holding up his fleshy hands. The point I'm getting at is that he believes in some form of the Hylian theoric world, and that there are other cosmi. Those are the topics Sur Akulawa is interested in.
So if the Hyphosa really exists, I said,
he or she summoned Paphlagon because the polycosm somehow became a hot topic.
And we are guessing that whatever made it hot also triggered the closure of the Starhenge.
Arcibald shrugged.
Well, what could that possibly be?
He shrugged again.
That's one for you and Jesri. But don't forget that the Pangendrums might simply be confused.
Finally, one day, I made it down into the subcellar of Schuf's Dalmont and spent 3 hours watching Saman eat lunches. He made the trip almost every day, but not always at the same time. If the weather was fine and the time of day was right, he would sit on the parapet, spread out some food on a little cloth, and enjoy the view while he ate. Sometimes he read a book. I couldn't identify all of his little morsels and delicacies, but they looked better than what we had for lunch. Sometimes, if the wind blew out of the northeast, we could smell the Eta cooking. It always seemed as if they were taunting us. Results, I proclaimed to Leo the next time I was alone with him in the meadow. Sort of.
Yeah?
You were right, I think.
Right about what?
For so much time had passed that he had forgotten our earlier talk about Saman. I had to remind him. Then he was taken aback.
Wow,
he said.
This is big.
Could be. I still don't know what to make of it, I said.
What does he do? Hold up a sign in front of the eye? Use sign language?
Saman's too clever for that, I said.
What? It sounds like you're speaking of an old friend.
I almost feel that way about him by this point. He and I have had a lot of lunches together.
So how does he... did he talk to you?
For the first 68 days... He's a real bore, I said. Then on day 69, something happens.
Day 69. What does that mean to the rest of us?
Well, it's about 2 weeks after the solstice and 9 days before Orlo got thrown back.
Okay. So what does Saman do on day 69?
Well, normally when he gets to the top of the stair, he unslings a bag from his shoulder and hangs it around a stone knob that sticks up from the parapet there. He cleans the optics, then he goes over and sits on the parapet. It has a flat top about a foot wide, and takes his lunch out of that bag and spreads it out there and eats it.
Okay. What happens on day 69?
In addition to the shoulder bag, he is carrying something cradled in one arm like a book. The first thing he does is set this down on the parapet. Then he goes about his usual routine.
So it's sitting there in plain view of the eye.
Exactly.
Can you zoom in on it?
Of course.
Can you read its title?
Turns out it's not a book at all, Leo. It is another dust jacket, just like the one Saman found up there the first day, except this one is big and heavy because it contains...
Another tablet,
Leo exclaimed, then paused to consider it.
I wonder what that means.
Well, we have to assume he had just picked it up elsewhere in the Starhenge.
He doesn't leave it there, I assume.
No. When he's finished eating, he takes it with him.
I wonder why he'd choose that day of all days to snatch a tablet.
Well, I'm thinking it must have been around day 69 that Frost Bellicon's investigation of Orlo really began to pick up steam. Now, you might remember that when I sneaked up there during the Anathem on day 78, I checked the M&M
and found it empty,
Leo said with a nod.
So, on day 69, Spellicon probably ordered Saman to fetch the tablet that Orlo had left in the M&M, which Saman did. But Spellicon didn't know about the one you'd put in Clesthra's eye, so he didn't ask for it.
But Saman knew, I reminded him. He had noticed it on day 2.
And had made up his mind not to tell Spellicon. But on day 69, he didn't try to hide the fact that he had just grabbed Orlo's tablet.
Leo shook his head.
I don't get it. Why would he risk letting you know that?
I threw up my hands. Maybe it's not such a risk for him. He's already Ida. What can they do to him?
Good point. They can't be nearly as afraid of the Warden Regulant as we are.
I was a little bit irritated to be reminded that we were afraid, but... considering all of the skulking around I'd been doing lately, I couldn't argue. I'd been getting better, I realized, recovering from the loss of Fra Orlo, forgetting how sad and angry I was. And when Leo mentioned the Warden Regulant, it reminded me. Anyway, there was a long silence now as Leo assimilated all of this. We actually got some work done. On the weeds, I mean.
Well,
he finally said.
What happens after that?
Day 70, cloudy. Day 71, snowing. Day 72, snowing. Can't see anything because the lens is covered. Day 73, it's brilliant weather. Most of the snow is melted off by the time Saman gets there. He cleans the place up and has lunch. He's wearing goggles.
Like sunglasses?
Bigger and thicker.
Like what mountain climbers wear?
That's what I thought at first, I said. Actually, I had to watch Day 73 several times before I got it.
Got what?
Leo asked.
It was bright. There was snow. He wore dark goggles.
Really dark, I said. I don't think that these were ordinary goggles like an outdoorsman would wear. I've seen these goggles before, Leo. When I saw Cord and Saman in the machine hall during Appert, they were wearing these things to shield their eyes from the arc. An arc that's as bright as the sun.
But why would Saman suddenly start wearing such a get-up to clean the lenses?
He doesn't actually have them on while he's cleaning. They're dangling around his neck on a strap, I said. Then he puts them on and eats his lunch as usual, but the entire time that he's eating, he's staring directly into the sun. Saman is watching the sun!
And he never did this before day 69?
Nope, never.
So do you think that he learned something?
Something from Fra Orlo's tablet, maybe? I said. Or something Spellicon told him? Or perhaps Scuttlebutt from other Ida and other Consents, talking or whatever they do over the reticulum?
Why watch the sun? That is completely off the track of what you've been doing, isn't it?
Completely.
but it's something. It is a big fat hint, a gift from Saman.
So, have you started looking at the sun, too?
I don't have goggles, I reminded him. But I do have 20-odd clear sunny days recorded on that tablet. So, starting tomorrow, I can at least look at what the sun was doing 3 and 4 months ago.
Big Three. The Consents of Sant Muncoster, Sant Tredegar, and Sant Barito, which are geographically close to one another and which have numerous characteristics in common, e.g., founded in 0 AR, relatively populous, richly endowed, and enjoying high status for past achievements. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
The next morning after a Theorix lecture, Jesri and Tuli and I went talking in the meadow. It was the first really fine spring day, and everyone was out walking around, so it felt as though we could do this without being conspicuous. I think I found the Hyphosa, Tulia announced.
You mean the Hyphosa,
Jesri corrected her.
No, I said. If Tulia has found such a person, it is no longer hypothetical.
I stand corrected, Jesri said.
Who is the important Fid?
Ignatha Forl, Tulia said.
The surname sounds vaguely familiar, Jesri said.
The family has been wealthy for a few hundred years, which makes them old and well-established by secular standards. They have a lot of ties to the Mathic world, especially Barito.
Sant Barito was adjacent to landforms that made a huge and excellent harbor when the sea level was behaving itself, when it wasn't buried in pack ice, and when the river that emptied into it had not dried up or been diverted. For about a third of the time since the reconstitution, a large city had existed around Barito's walls, not always the same city, of course, and so it had the reputation of being urban and worldly, with many ties to families such as, apparently, the Forals. The Procyons were powerful there, and in their Unarian math they trained many young seculars who later went into law, politics, and commerce.
What are we allowed to know of her?
Jesri asked. The question was aptly phrased. Once a year, at annual Appert, our Unarians reviewed summaries of the secular news of the year just ended. Then, once every 10 years, just before decennial Appert, they reviewed the previous 10 annual summaries and compiled a decennial summary, which became part of our library delivery. The only criterion for a news item to make it into a summary was that it still had to seem interesting. This filtered out essentially all of the news they made up the secular world's daily papers and casts. Jesri was asking Tulia what Ignatha Forl had done that was interesting enough to have made it into the most recent decennial summary. She had an important post in the government. She was one of the dozen or so highest-ranking people, and she took a stand against the Warden of Heaven, and he got rid of her.
Killed her?
No.
Threw her into a dungeon?
No, just fired her. I speculate that she has some other job now where she still has enough pull to voco someone like Paphlagon.
So, she was a Fid of Sur Akulua?
Ignatha Forl spent 6 years in the Unarian math at Barito and wrote a treatise comparing Paphlagon's work to that of some other,
people like Paphlagon, Jesri said impatiently.
Yeah, of previous centuries.
Did you read it?
We didn't get a copy. Maybe in another 10 years. I already went into the lower labyrinth and shoved a request through the grill.
Someone at Barito, presumably a Unarian Fid, would have to copy Forl's treatise by hand and send it to us.
If a book were very popular, Fids would do this without being asked, and copies would circulate to other maths.
You'd think a rich family would have had copies machine-printed, Jesri said.
Too vulgar, Tulia said. But I know the title. Plurality of Worlds, a Comparative Study of Polycosmic Ideation Among the Helicarnians.
Makes me feel like a bug under the Procyon's magnifying glass, I said.
Barito is Procyon-dominated, Tulia reminded me. She wasn't going to get anywhere calling it Why the Helicarnians Are So Much Smarter Than Us.
Too late, I remembered that Tulia belonged to a Procyon order now. So she was interested in the polycosm, Jesri said, before this could flourish into a spat.
What could have happened that would be observable from the Starhenge and that would make the polycosm relevant? It was the sort of question Jessery would never ask unless he already knew the answer, which he now supplied. Something's gone wrong with the sun, I'll bet. I was poised to scoff, but held back, reflecting that Saman had, after all, been looking at the sun. Something visible with the naked eye? Sunspots, solar flares. These can affect our weather, and so on. And ever since the Praxic Age, the atmosphere doesn't protect us from certain things. Well, if that's where the action is, why was Orlo looking at the North Pole?
The aurora,
Jessery said, as if he actually knew what he was talking about.
It responds to solar flares.
But we haven't had a single decent aurora this whole time, Tullia pointed out, with a cat-like look of satisfaction on her face.
That we could see with the naked eye, Jessery returned. This tablet of ours could be the perfect instrument for observing not only auroras, but the disk of the sun itself.
I notice it's our tablet now that it's got something good on it, I pointed out. If Sir Trestinus finds it, it'll go back to being your tablet, Tullia said. She and I laughed, but Jessery was determined not to be amused. Seriously, Tullia continued, that hypothesis doesn't explain why they evoked Paphlagon. Any cosmographer can look at solar flares.
What's the connection to the polycosm, you're asking? Jessery said.
Exactly.
Maybe there is none, I speculated.
Maybe Ignatha Forel just wanted a cosmographer and happened to remember Paphlagon's name.
Maybe she's being persecuted as a heretic, and they yanked Paphlagon so that they could burn him too, Jessery suggested.
And we chatted about such ideas for a few minutes before discarding all of them in favor of the proposition that Paphlagon must have been chosen for some good reason.
Well, Jessery said, the way that the Theors of old found themselves talking about the polycosm in the first place was by thinking about stars, how they formed and what went on inside them.
Formation of nuclei and so on, Tullia said.
And not only that, but when the stars die, how do these nuclei get blown out into space so that they can form planets and...
And us, I said.
Yeah, Jessery said. At least to the question... Why are all of these processes so fine-tuned to produce life? A sticky question. Deolaters would say, see, God made the cosmos just for us. But the polycosmic answer is, no, there must be lots of cosmi, some good for life, most not. We only see one cosmos in which we are capable of existing. And that is where all of this philosophical stuff originated that Sura Akulua likes to study.
I think I see where you're going now when you guessed something's gone wrong with the sun, I said. Maybe there are some new solar observations that contradict what we thought we knew about the theorics of what goes on in the cores of stars. And maybe this has ramifications that extend all the way to those polycosmic theories that Paphlagon's interested in.
Or, more likely, Ignatha Forel mistakenly thinks so she's yanked Paphlagon and is now sending him on a wild goose chase, Jessery said.
I think she's pretty smart, Tullia demurred, but Jessery didn't hear her because a resolution was forming in his head. He turned toward me.
I want to go down there and view this with you, he said, or without you if you're busy.
For about 12 different reasons, I hated this idea, but I couldn't say so without making it look like I was trying to be a pig and monopolize the tablet.
Fine, I said.
Are you sure that's a good idea? Tullia said, sounding as if she was pretty sure it wasn't. But before this could develop into a proper fight, we all took notice of the approach of Sur Ayla, who was heading straight for us across the meadow.
Uh-oh,
Jessery said. Sur Ayla was unusual-looking in a way I'd never been able to pin down. Sometimes I found myself staring at her during lectures or at Provener, trying to make sense of her face. She had a round head on a slender neck, lately accentuated by a short haircut she had gotten during Appert. Since then, one of the other sewers had been maintaining this for her. She had huge eyes, a delicate sharp nose, and a wide mouth. She was small and bony, where Tullia was generous. Anyway, there was something about her physical form that matched her soul.
she didn't waste time greeting us.
Oh, for the 800th time in the last 3 months, Fra Erasmus is at the center of a heated conversation. Carefully out of earshot of others, complete with significant glances at the sky and at Shuf's dalmant, she began. Don't bother trying to explain it away. I know you guys are up to something. Have been for weeks and weeks.
We all stood there for a long moment. My heart was pounding. Ayla was squared off against the three of us, scanning our faces with those searchlight eyes.
All right, Jessery said. We won't bother.
But that was all he said. There followed another long silence. I was expecting a look of fury to come over Ayla's face, for her to make a threat to bring down the Inquisition on us, instead of which her face slowly collapsed. For a moment I thought she might show some other emotion. I couldn't guess what. But she passed from there to a blank, resolute look, turned her back on us, and began walking away. After she had gone a few paces, Tullia went after her, leaving Jessery and me alone.
That was weird, he observed.
I could hardly respond. The miserable feeling that had kept me awake in my cell on the night that Ayla had joined the new circle had come over me again. You think she'll rat us out? I asked him. I tried to put it in an incredulous tone of voice, as in, are you really stupid enough to think she'd rat us out? But Jessery took it at face value.
It would be a great way to score points with the Warden Regulant.
But she was careful to approach us when no one else was around, I pointed out.
Maybe in hopes of negotiating some kind of deal with us?
What do we have to offer in the way of a deal? I snorted. Jessery thought about it and shrugged.
Our bodies? Now you're just being obnoxious.
Why don't you say our affections if you're going to make such jokes?
Because I don't think I have any affection for Ayla, Jessery said. And I don't think she has any for me.
Come on, she's not that bad.
How can you say that after the little performance she just put on?
Maybe she was trying to warn us that we're being too obvious.
Well, she might have a point there, Jessery admitted. We should stop talking out in the open where the whole math can observe us.
You have a better idea?
Yeah. The subcellar of Shuf's Dalmant. Next time Arcibald sends us the signal.
As it turned out, this was only about 4 hours later. It all worked fine, superficially. Arcibald sent the signal. Jessery and I noticed it from different places and converged on Shuf's Dalmant. No one was there except for Arcibald. Jessery and I went below and got to work. But in every other way, it was wrong from the start. Whenever I went to Shuf's Dalmant, I took a circuitous route through the back of the Page Tree Coppice. I never went the same way twice. Jessery, on the other hand, just crossed the bridge and made a beeline for it. But I couldn't say his way was any worse than mine, because that day I encountered no fewer than 4 different people, or groups of people, out strolling around to enjoy the weather. Within a stone's throw of the Dalmant, I almost tripped over Sir Terry and Fra Branch, who were enjoying a private moment together, all wrapped up in each other's bolts. When I finally reached the building, it was with the intent of calling the thing off, but Jessery wasn't about to walk away. He talked me into going down there as Arcibald looked on, growingly horrified, eyes jumping from door to window to door. So down we went, and crammed ourselves into that tiny space where I had spent so many hours by myself. But it wasn't the same with him there. I'd grown used to the geometric distortion wreaked by the lens. He hadn't, and spent a lot of time zooming in on different things just to see what they looked like. It was no different from what I had done on my first few sessions with it. But it made me want to scream. He didn't seem to understand that we did not have time for this. When he got really interested in something, he would talk much too loudly. Both of us had to go out and urinate. I had to teach him about the all-clear signal involving the door. It seemed like 2 or 3 hours went by before we actually got around to observing the sun. The tablet worked as well for this as it did for looking at distant stars. It could only generate so much light, and so the sun appeared not as a blinding thermonuclear fireball, but as a crisp-edged disk. The brightest thing on the tablet, certainly, but not so bright you couldn't look at it. If you zoomed in on it, and turned down the brightness, you could observe sunspots. I couldn't really say whether there was an exceptional number of these. Neither could Jessery. By blacking out the sun's disk and observing the space around it, we could look for solar flares. But there was nothing unusual going on that we could see. Not that either of us was an expert on such things. We'd never paid much attention to the sun before, considering it an obnoxious, wayward star that interfered with our observations of all the other stars. After we became discouraged and convinced ourselves that the hypothesis about Saman and the goggles was wrong, and that we had wasted the whole afternoon, we attempted to leave, and found the door at the top of the stairs closed. Someone else was in the building. It wasn't safe to go out. We waited for half an hour. Maybe Archibald had closed the door in error. I crept up and put my ear to it. He was carrying on a conversation with someone there, and the longer I listened to their muffled voices, the more certain I became that the other person up there was Sur Ayla. She had tracked us here. Jessery had uncomplimentary things to say about her when I came back down to report this news. Half an hour later, she was still there. Both of us were starving. Archibald must be in a state of animalistic terror. Clearly, our secret was out, or soon to be out, to at least one person. Squatting there in the darkness, trapped like rats, we had more than enough time to think through the implications. To go on as if this had not happened would be senseless. So, having nothing else to do, we pulled the polytarp up off the floor and wrapped the tablet in it. Then we maneuvered and squirmed into the remotest place we could find, the utmost frontier of Archibald's explorations, and used his shovel to bury the tablet 4 feet deep. When we were finished with that project and nicely covered with dirt, I went up and put my ear to the door again. This time I heard no conversation, but the door was still closed. "I think Archibald has abandoned us in favor of supper," I told Jessery. "But I'll bet she's still up there."
"It's not in her character to leave at this point," Jessery said.
"Say, that's the nicest thing you've ever said about her."
"What do you think we should do, Raz?"
It was strange to hear Jessery asking for my views on any topic. I savored this novel experience for a few moments before saying,
"If she intends to rat us out, I'm dead no matter what, but you have a chance. So let's go out together. You hood yourself and go straight out the back door and make yourself scarce. I'll approach Ayla and talk to her. She'll be distracted long enough for you to melt into the darkness."
"It's a deal,"
Jessery said.
"Thanks, Raz. And remember, if it's your body that she wants—"
"Shut up."
"Okay, let's do it,"
Jessery said, pulling his bolt over his head. But I could see him shaking his head at the same time.
"Can you believe this is what passes for excitement around this place?
Maybe someday your wish will be granted, and something will happen in the world."
"I thought this might be it,"
he said, nodding toward the subcellar.
"But so far, there's nothing but sunspots."
The door opened, and a light shone on us. "Hello, boys," said Sur Ayla. "Lose your way?" Jessery was hooded. She couldn't see his face. He decided to execute the plan in spite of this minor glitch. He bounded up the stairs, pushed his way past Ayla, and headed for the back door. I was right behind him. I came face to face with Sur Ayla just in time to hear a terrible thud from down the hall. Jessery was sprawled over the threshold, covered by a mess of bolt from the waist up.
"No point hiding, Jessery. I'd know your smile anywhere," Ayla called.
Jessery got his legs under him, let his bolt drop back down over his arse, and ran off. Now that my eyes had adjusted to the light, I could see that Ayla had stretched her cord across the doorway at ankle level and tied it off between a couple of chairs flanking the exit. Lacking any other way to keep her bolt on, she had thrown it over herself loosely and was holding it up with one arm. She turned her back on me and shuffled over to retrieve the cord.
"Archibald left an hour ago," she said. "I think he lost half his weight in perspiration."
I couldn't muster a lot of amusement, since I knew she was in a position to say equally funny things about me or Jessery if she wanted.
"Cat got your tongue?"
she asked, after a good long while.
"How many other people know?"
You mean how many have I told, or how many have figured it out on their own?
I guess both.
I've told no one. As to the other question, I guess the answer would be anyone who pays as much attention to you as I do, which probably means no one.
Why would you pay attention to me?
She rolled her eyes.
Good question.
Look, what do you want, Ayla? What are you after?
It's part of the rules of the game that I mustn't tell you.
If this is about you trying to be some sort of junior warden regulant, her little protege, then get it over with. Go and tell her. I'll march out of the day gate at sunrise and go find Orlo.
She was winding her cord about herself as I said this. Suddenly, the bolt seemed to grow twice as large as all of the breath went out of her. Her chest collapsed, and her head drooped. The big eyes closed for a few moments. Here was where any other girl her age would have gone to pieces.
It is hard to say just how monstrous I felt.
I leaned back against the wall and let my head thud back as if attempting to escape from my own hideously guilty skin. But there was no way out of it. She had opened her eyes. They were gleaming, but they saw everything. Anyone who pays as much attention to you as I do, which means no one. In a voice almost too quiet to hear, she said,
"You need to take a bath." For once in my life, I actually managed to see the double meaning.
But Ayla was already gone.
11. The list of plants forbidden intramuros, typically because of their undesirable pharmacological properties. The discipline states that any specimen noticed growing in a math is to be uprooted and burned without delay, and that the event is to be noted in the chronicle. The list originally drawn up by Sant Cartus included only 3, but their number was increased over the centuries as Arbre was explored and new species were discovered. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
I'd have become a deolator and gone on a pilgrimage of any length to find a magic bath that would wash away the mess I had just made. The hardships of the journey would have been pleasant compared to my next week or so in the math. Not that Ayla told anyone. She was too proud for that. But all the other sewers, beginning with Tulia, could tell she was suffering. And by breakfast the next morning, everyone had decided it must be my fault. I wondered how this worked. My first hypothesis was wrong on the face of it, that Ayla had run home and narrated the story to a chalk hall full of appalled sewers. My second hypothesis was that she had been seen coming home miserable after having missed supper. I had been seen skulking home a little while later. Ergo, I had done a bad thing to her. It wasn't until later that I understood the much simpler truth. Others had noticed that Ayla had her eye on me, and so if Ayla were miserable, it could only be because I had done something, it didn't matter what, bad. In a stroke, I had been thrown back by every young female in the math. All the girls seemed to be aghast all the time, because that was the look that would come over every girl's face when she saw me. The thing grew over time. If Ayla had simply written up an account of what I'd done and stapled it to my chest, it wouldn't have been so bad. But because the amount of information about what I had done was exactly 0, people's imaginations went crazy. Young sewers cringed away from me. Older ones glared at me through supper. "It doesn't matter what you did, young man. We know you did something." I did not see Ayla again for 4 days, which was statistically improbable. It suggested that other sewers were acting as lookouts, tracking my movements so that they could tell Ayla where not to be. Arcibald was so rattled that he could hardly speak until 3 days later. When he came to supper all dirty and told me in a whisper that he had dug up the tablet from where Jessery and I had buried it,
ridiculously easy to find,
and hid it in a much better place,
safe and sound.
Jessery and I knew better than to try to find any object that Arcibald considered to be safe and sound. All we could do was wait for him to calm down. I figured out why I never saw Ayla. She and Tulia were spending an inordinate amount of time at the Minster,
doing some maintenance on the bells, practicing weird changes, and passing their knowledge down to the younger girls who would eventually replace them. Sunny days came more frequently. I could look up to the top of the spire sometimes and see Saman eating his lunch and staring fixedly into the sun through his goggles. Jesri and I discussed smoking a pane of glass and using it to do likewise, but we knew that if we did it wrong, we'd go blind. I even contemplated going over the wall, running off to the machine hall, and borrowing a welding mask from Cord. But all of these were really nothing more than distractions to get my mind off the Ayla problem. Early on, I thought of this as a matter of salvaging my reputation, but as time went by and I thought about it harder, the real nature of the thing became clear. I had made a mess inside of someone else's soul at a moment when that soul had been opened to me. Now it was closed. I was the only one who could clean up the mess, but in order to do this, I first had to get in there, and I had no idea how. Especially in the case of someone as fierce as Ayla. But it occurred to me one day as I was pursuing the weed project that unilateral disarmament might work with someone like her. The work Leo and I had been doing along the riverbank was bringing me into contact with many spring wildflowers. The girls were up in the minster doing maintenance on the belfry. Suddenly, it all seemed obvious. I put the plan into motion before I'd really thought it through. 10 minutes later, I was sleepwalking up the minster stairs with a bunch of flowers on my arm, covered under a fold of my bolt because one of them was of the 11 and I was about to carry it straight through the warden regulant's court. The portcullis was still locked down, the stair up the buttress inaccessible, the upper presidium off limits. Our Carolyn was in the lower reaches of the chronochasm, reachable by a ladder that ran up from the fendant court. This route dead-ended in a sort of maintenance shack just below the Carolyn. You couldn't go any higher up the presidium that way, so I could go up there without arousing any concern that I might be attempting to look at the forbidden sky. The bells themselves were open to the weather. Below them was this shack that sheltered some of the machinery that made the bells ring. I could hear Ayla and Tulia up there talking. The ladder led up to a trap door in its floor. My heart was bonging like a bell as I climbed. I gripped the rungs hard so I wouldn't fall off. I had stuffed the flowers into my bolt to leave both hands free, and now I was sweating all over the blossoms. Disgusting. Ayla laughed at some witty remark of Tulia's. I was happy to hear that she was capable of laughter. Then chagrined in a weird way that she'd already gotten over me. There was no way to make a smooth entrance. I shoved the trapdoor up and out of my way. The girls became silent. I heaved the bouquet through the aperture and dumped it on the floor to one side, thinking that this would make a more favorable first impression than my face, which of late had practically made young females run screaming. But this was only delaying the inevitable. My face was attached to the rest of me. It and I would have to arrive together. I poked the sorry thing up through the door and looked around, but couldn't see a thing. The shack had windows, but they'd been covered. The girls, however, recognized me with their dark-adjusted eyes and became even more silent, if such a thing is possible. I hauled the rest of me up through the door. Tulia made her sphere emit light. She and Ayla were sitting side by side on the floor, leaning back against the wall. I wondered why. But I was leery of opening my mouth for any purpose other than the one at hand. So I knelt to one side of the trap door and regathered the bouquet. This gave me a few moments to realize I had no plan and nothing to say. But having grown up with Sur Ayla and knowing how she reacted to things, I reckoned I couldn't go wrong asking permission. Ayla, I would like to give you these if it wouldn't kill you. At least one of them inhaled. Neither raised an objection. The place was larger than I imagined, but so cluttered with beams and shafts, I wasn't certain I could stand up, so I knee-walked over to where they were sitting. Something brushed past me. A bat? But the next time I took account of persons in the room, which was much later, There were only two of us. So it must have been Tullia teleporting herself out of the place like a space captain in a spiele.
Thank you,
Ayla said, guardedly.
Did you carry these things up through the Regulant Court? I guess you must have.
I did, I said.
Why?
Though I already knew why.
This one here is Sant Chandra's Bane, isn't it? Sant Chandra's Bane makes a weird-looking blossom around this time of year, which I have decided is beautiful.
I was getting ready to make an analogy to Ayla's appearance, but faltered, wondering how to phrase the part about her being kind of weird-looking.
But it's one of the 11. I'm aware of it,
I said, getting a little tense, as she had broken into my analogy only to start a dispute.
Like, I put it there because it's forbidden. And this thing between you and me, this mess that I made, is all about something else that's forbidden.
I can't believe you carried this right up the stairs under the nose of the Inquisition.
Okay, now that you mention it, it was pretty stupid.
That wasn't the word I was going to use, she said.
Thanks for bringing these.
You're welcome.
If you sit next to me, I'll show you something I'll bet you never expected, she said. And here I was pretty sure there wasn't a double meaning. By the time I'd got myself seated in Tullia's former spot, Ayla had already climbed to her feet. She could stand up in here at least, and padded over to the trap door, which Tullia had left open. Ayla closed it. She sat next to me and extinguished her light. It was totally dark in here now. Totally dark, that is, except for a single splotch of white light about the size of the palm of Ayla's hand that seemed to hover in space just in front of us. I didn't imagine that this was a coincidence. The girls had been sitting here because of the splotch of light. I reached out and explored it with my right hand. The left, curiously, was beyond use as it had somehow ended up around Ayla's shoulders. There was a plank leaning against the wall with a blank leaf pinned to it, and the light splotch was being projected against that leaf. Now that my eyes had adjusted, I could see that the splotch was round, perfectly circular, in fact.
Do you remember the total eclipse of 3680 when we made a camera obscura so we could see it without burning our eyes?
A box, I recalled, with a pinhole at one end and a sheet of white paper at the other.
Tullia and I have been spring cleaning up here, she said. We noticed these patches of sunlight moving around on the floor and the walls. They were shining through from an old opening up high in the wall, over that-a-way.
She squirmed as she pointed invisibly in the dark and somehow ended up closer to me.
We think it was put there to ventilate the place, then boarded up because bats were getting in. The light was leaking in through chinks between the boards. We fixed it. Almost.
That almost being a nice, neat little pinhole?
Exactly, and we set up the screen down here. We have to move it, obviously, as the sun moves across the sky.
Ayla could insert the word obviously into an otherwise polite sentence like nobody's business. I had spent more than half of my life being sporadically annoyed by it. Here, finally, I let it go. I was too busy admiring the cleverness of Tullia and Ayla.
I wish I had thought of this.
You didn't need a lens or a mirror of ground and polished glass to see things far away. A simple pinhole could serve as well. The image that it cast was faint, though, and so you had to view it in a dark room. A camera obscura. Apparently, Tullia had told Ayla everything about the tablet, about Saman, and about my observations. But it seemed like years since I had cared about that stuff as much as I cared about fixing my mess. In fact, as we sat there in the dark together, I was finding it difficult to muster even the least bit of interest in the sun. It was shining. Photosynthesis was safe. There were no major flares and only a few spots. Who cared? It was even harder to care a few minutes later. Kissing was not a subject taught in chalk halls. We had to learn by trial and error. Even the errors were not too bad.
A spark,
Ayla said, muffled somewhat, a while later.
I'll say.
No, I thought I saw a spark.
I'm told it's normal to see stars at times like this.
Don't flatter yourself, she said, and heaved me aside.
I just saw another one.
Where?
On the screen.
Somewhat bleary-eyed, I turned my attention that away. Nothing was on that page except the same pale white disk. And a spark. A pinprick of light, brighter than the sun, gone before I could be certain it was there.
I think, there it is again, she exclaimed. It moved a little, though.
We watched a few more.
She was right.
All of the sparks were below and to the right of the sun's disk, but each one was slightly higher and farther to the left. If you plotted them on the page, they'd form a line aimed right at the sun.
What would Orlo do?
We need a pen, I said.
Don't have one, she said. They're coming about once a second, maybe faster.
Is there anything sharp?
The pins!
Ayla and Tullia had used 4 stick pins to fix the page to the plank. I worried one loose and let it tumble into her warm little hand.
I'm going to hold the plank still. You poke a hole in the page wherever you see a spark, I said.
We missed a few more while we were getting ourselves arranged. I knelt to one side, bracing the plank against the wall with my hand, holding its base steady with my knee. She threw herself down on her belly and propped herself up on her elbows, her face so close to the page that I could see her eyes and the curve of her cheek and the faint illumination scattering from the page. She was the most beautiful girl in the consent. I saw the next spark reflected in her eye. Up came her hand as she poked it on the page.
It would be really good if we knew the exact time, I said.
Poke.
In a few minutes, this is
poke.
Going to migrate off the page, obviously.
Poke.
Then we can run out and look at
poke.
The clock.
Poke.
Notice anything funny about these sparks?
Poke.
They're not instant on-off.
Poke.
They flare up quickly.
Poke.
But fade slowly.
Poke.
I was referring to the color.
Poke.
Kind of bluey?
Poke. A sudden grinding noise nearly gave me a heart attack. It was the belfry's automatic mechanism going into action. The clock was striking 2. At this time, it would have been traditional to plug one's ears. I didn't dare. Ayla would have assailed me with that jabbing pin.
Poke, poke, poke.
So much for knowing the time,
I said when I thought she might be able to hear again.
I made a triple hole on the spark that came closest to the stroke of 2, she said.
Perfect.
I think it's been curving, she said.
Curving?
Like, whatever makes these sparks isn't moving in a straight line. It is changing its course, she said. It's obviously flying between us and the sun. It's passing right across the sun's disk at the moment, but the line of pinholes doesn't look straight to me.
Well, assuming it's in orbit, that's really weird, I said. It ought to go straight.
Unless it's in the act of changing its course, she insisted. Maybe these sparks are something to do with its propulsion system.
I remember now where I've seen that shade of blue before, I said.
Where?
Cord shop. They have a machine that uses plasma to cut metal. The light that comes from it is that shade of blue, the same as a hot star.
It's passing off the edge of the sun's disk, she said.
Then,
hey!
Hey, what?
It stopped.
No more sparks?
No more sparks. I'm sure of it.
Well, before I move this thing, make some pinpricks around the edge of the disk of the sun so we know where it stood in relation to all this. Between that and the time, we can find this thing.
Find it how?
We can work out where in the sky the sun stood at 2 p.m. on this day of the year. That is, which of the so-called fixed stars it's passing in front of. This plasma spark thing that we were tracking, it was in the same place. That means that unless it changes its orbit again, it will pass over the same fixed stars on each orbit. We can find it in the sky.
But it seems to have no difficulty changing its orbit, said Ayla,
meticulously outlining the sun's disk with a series of closely spaced pinpricks.
But part of the puzzle we fail to understand until now, maybe, is that it only does so when it's passing near the sun. So as long as we have this camera obscura, we can be on the lookout for that. Why should the sun's position make any difference?
I think it's hiding, I said.
If it did what it just did in the night sky, anyone could see it with the naked eye.
But we were able to detect it with a pinhole in a sheet of paper, Ayla pointed out. So it's a pretty ineffective way to hide.
And Saman can apparently see it with welding goggles, I said.
But the difference is that people like you and me and Saman are...
Are what? She said.
Knowledgeable?
Yeah.
And whoever or whatever this thing is, it doesn't or they don't care if knowledgeable people know they are up there. They are letting their existence be known to us, which the secular power doesn't like,
which is why Orlo got thrown back for looking at it.